Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is a remarkable cookbook author. She's a teacher. She writes superbly well, and she loves cooking. Her name is June Hirsch. She's the author of Recipes Remembered, a book of recipes and stories from Holocaust survivors, and Kosher Carnivore, her latest book, which is all about meat, how to cook it, how to buy it, how to enjoy it. Good evening, Joan.
Hi, good evening, Chaim.
Let's talk a little bit about how you came about this project. Specifically, what suddenly happened that you got the brilliant idea of writing a book about Holocaust survivors and the food that they enjoyed? That is a very unusual approach. How did you come up with it?
It is an unusual approach, but when you think about it, food is the thread that weaves through all of our lives. It's what we remember as children. It's what we carry forward with us as adults. And for Holocaust survivors especially, it was a connection from their childhood and a really beautiful and happy time in their lives through the horrific period of the Holocaust and into the present time where they were able to nourish and nurture their own families the way they were remembered, you know, being nurtured in their own homes as children. So it almost really unfolded as a very organic idea, and it seemed like a natural link to me to bring a group of people, a remarkable community, back to a very happy and safe and comfortable time in their lives.
What I like about the book is not just the recipes, it's much more than that. Each person that you interviewed, aside from talking about their recipes, aside from talking either to that person or to one of their children, each one of those stories is a slice of life. They almost come alive as you see the photograph, as you read about them. You can almost see, you can almost hear them as you speak to them or about them.
And I'm smiling at the other end because I'm glad that that's what comes through, because that's what seemed so special to me about the book and about all of the conversations that I had with these really incredible people, this remarkable community that honestly survived what most of us can't possibly even imagine. And yet they managed to do it with such a positive attitude. And the stories in the book really bring to life their experiences. Having spoken to so many people, I mean, I spoke to well over 80, 100 people who had lived through the Holocaust or children of survivors who, you know, grew up in a household hearing these stories. And rather than their attitude being negative and their perspective being bitter, on the contrary, they were filled with so much life. That's why the book is subtitled A Celebration of Survival, because quite honestly, we are really celebrating the fact that these people are here, that they are the voices for so many voices that were silenced, that they were willing to share their stories, such intimate moments in their life. They shared it with me, a perfect stranger, and they did it because they wanted to convey to anyone who picks up this book or hears about it how vital it is for us to tell these stories and preserve their food memories, because that's why they survived. They survived so that they could have a legacy and they could continue the Jewish faith and the Jewish traditions and all of the beautiful things that they associated with their lives prior to the war and the wonderful things that they brought forward to their lives after the war. So, yes, it's joyful. The book really resonates with a happy voice, which I think is many people feel must have been a very difficult task. And truthfully, the people I spoke to made it very, very easy. The ones I spoke to are truly happy. They're happy to be here. They're secure in their faith. And they wanted to share their story.
Among the most remarkable stories that I found, for example, were that of Sonia and Zeus Belsky, mm-hmm. as told by their children. Zeus was one of the Belsky brothers after whom the movie Defiance was made.
Yes, and they are responsible for 1,200 peasants who really were, they're not trained militia. They were teenagers. They were children.
Right.
They were wives. They were mothers. And the Bielskis were responsible for taking these people and bringing them into the depth of the forest and returning to them really to the edge of freedom. And when I spoke to Zvi, the son of one of the Bielski brothers, and I said to him, what was it like growing up in a household with your father and your uncles who saved 1,200 people from whom 20,000 progeny came, which is just amazing to think that because of these 1,200 survivors, we have 20,000 more Jewish people on this earth. And I said, what was it like, Zvi, to have that person, those people, as your father and your uncles? And he said to me without missing a beat, he said, most of my friends had to read comic books to learn about superheroes. I only had to look across the dinner table. And I love that because it's, you know, I marveled at what some of the people in the book, some of my new friends, my survivors, told me they endured. And it's just, it's unfathomable to us in present-day time that somebody at the age of 7 or 8 had to learn how to cope without parents, without siblings, to be on the streets, to be in a ghetto by themselves. And yet they did. And they're here to tell those stories. That's the celebration.
Well, you cover survivors from many countries, whether it's Poland, whether it's Russia, the Ukraine, Germany, Austria, Greece. A lot of those recipes, as a child of survivors who grew up in Uruguay, mm-hmm. a lot of those recipes are very familiar to me.
That doesn't surprise me.
Right. I took the book in a very personal way because it brought back so many memories. For example, what doctor would agree that you can eat such a thing as Grebenessen Schmaltz? And yet here comes a funny thing. Most of my generation in Uruguay, I am sure in the States no less, but most of my generation in Uruguay, most of us were children of survivors. We grew up with that. And somehow, because we walked a lot, because we exercised a lot, I mean, there was no such thing as being driven to school or taking a school bus. You
right.
had to walk. And I guess we just worked out all the extra fat that way, all the extra cholesterol.
I think
shows
that
you that
time, to do with
times
it.
Were simpler, we could enjoy better food. And somehow, in spite of all the sophistication we get today, all the things that were once simple pleasures today are suddenly no good.
I think
we
the
have
main
lost a lot.
Difference, I think the main thing that I learned from cooking in this style and preparing the foods, because I tested every single recipe in the book. I post recipes constantly to my website at junehirsch.com, and I post recipes
and specifically to your blog.
And I post them to my blog, and those are linked to my Twitter and my Facebook and all the wonderful vehicles for getting these recipes out there. And what I find with their food is the difference is we eat huge portions here in America. We don't really understand what it means to have a small plate of food. That's just something that's not in our realm. And so when I look at some of the dishes that they prepared, and I agree with you, my grandparents lived to very, very old, healthy ages, and they ate these foods. But the difference is they didn't eat platters of it. They had a little bit of it. They had my grandmother
because they didn't eat in my mother's kitchen.
but they would just taste a little. They would try a little. They would have a little. They didn't eat a plate of Grebenessen and Schmaltz. They had a little bit of it smeared on a piece of bread.
Right.
And so
right.
if you can learn to eat with a little bit of moderation, you know, I laugh. At the end of writing the book and testing all of the recipes, my husband looked at me, and he's a good man, and he cleaned up my mess every night. And he said to me, you know, sweetheart, for 1 year, we have eaten like 85-year-old Polish peasants. And we laughed because it's not such a bad way to eat. They ate organic food. They ate food that was locally grown. They ate animals and meat that was slaughtered that day on the farm next door. Mm-hmm. And so the food they ate were not tainted with additives and with antibiotics and all of the other terrible things, which is why kosher meat, and it led me to writing the second book, but which is why kosher meat really is an alternative whether you're kosher or not, because it is healthier on so many levels that you can probably indulge a little bit more, but it's just not as bad for you.
As a matter of fact, the main kosher restaurants are in business not just because of their Jewish customers. They would not have lasted very long.
That's correct.
As one of the people with whom you consulted when you were writing the Kosher Carnivore, Chef David Kolatkin from Prime Grill, as he can tell you, they quite often have more non-Jews coming into that restaurant than they have Jews.
I think that's very accurate. It's funny, and Chaim, I'm going to assume you are not necessarily a New York Knicks devoted fan, but I could be wrong. But I'm a pretty good Knicks fan. And there is a player who plays for the New York Knicks. His name is Amari Stoudemire. And you would not think, but Amari Stoudemire, who found his Jewish roots via his grandmother, who turned out to be Jewish, and he is embracing that part of his identity, he only buys kosher meat. And he has a chef that prepares many kosher dishes for him because he just feels there is cleanliness and other healthful factors in eating kosher products. And so it is not just a Jewish thing. It is really becoming a very trendy thing to eat kosher and keep kosher.
Right. As I leaf through the pages and I see so many recipes that my mother makes recipes and used to make, I mean, I can almost smell the kitchen. I can almost smell the house, and not just from the Gribenes and Schmaltz.
Right.
As also from the Chont, coming back from shul on Friday on a Shabbos morning.
Mm-hmm.
So many
and
others.
And that's really, you know, the book was meant to do two things with regard to the food. One was to ensure that the dishes that we associate with our culture, with the Jewish culture, that they find a home, that they are interpreted with measurements that you can actually cook from, which was really one of my biggest challenges. You know, Shitterein, most of the cooks, is a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and you can't write a recipe like that for a good cookbook. You need to give measurements. And by doing that in Recipes Remembered, I feel we're now able to take these recipes that maybe were prepared in every one of our homes, but they're now on paper, they're now with measurements, they're with clear directions, and it's now possible for the next generation who might not have asked their grandparents how to make something. They might not know how to prepare a kugel or a special tort for Passover or the best matzo balls, whether you like them floating or sinking. They might not know those things. And now they're in this book. The second thing that I wanted to do with the food that was really important to me was to present such a wide range of dishes so that a roast kanpolyo becomes a Jewish food. Do you know why it's a Jewish food? It's a Jewish food because it's made by Jewish people. Because if you think about it...
You mean it is not a Jewish food? My mother was actually making non-Jewish food.
Well,
I find it hard to believe.
Some people think that that's a Latin dish or a dish, and it is.
Well, yes, I grew up in Uruguay, of course.
Oh, well, you grew up in Uruguay, so you understand that. And what made the food your mother cooked Jewish? It was made by a Jewish woman.
It was made by a Jewish woman and according to the strictest standards of kashrut.
Exactly.
Very different from my neighbors.
And I'm sure that's true. And I look at the recipes in the book because the book is strictly kosher. And I look at and many of them truly are not kosher anymore. Many of my survivors were not kosher. But out of respect to those who were and out of respect to those who are no longer here, the book is strictly kosher. And in doing so, we have given voice to recipes from Greece, from Belgium, whether it's endives with beer, or it's a lentil soup with balsamic vinegar, or it's a tre leche cake from the Dominican Republic, it's all Jewish food because it was prepared by Jewish people in Jewish homes according to Jewish law. And that's what makes it Jewish food. That's part of the wonderful part of the book. Recipes Remembered are recipes that are remembered from every corner of the world. And I love that it represents not just those dishes that we all associate, the brisket and the chopped liver and the soup, but it represents other unexpected dishes, breasts of veal and yellow pepper soup and a wonderful beef brajol. These are all Jewish foods in this book made by Jewish Holocaust survivors. It makes it very unique.
Another thing that I find very interesting in this book, and it's one of the reasons I can read the book even if I am not looking for a specific recipe, is your writing style. It is obvious that you have emotionally engaged with the people that you have interviewed, and you write so beautifully.
Thank you.
The first time I ever saw a book that did more than just give you recipes like the books, the cookbooks of the olden days, was John Nathan, whom you mentioned in this book, who even contributed some recipes.
Yes,
her first book was called. Yeah, her first book was called The Flavor of Jerusalem, when she was working in Jerusalem for then Mayor Teddy Kollek.
Mm-hmm.
And each recipe was prefaced by a little write-up about whoever it was that gave her the recipe, the area of Yerushalayim from where the recipe came, and you felt like you were almost there. You could almost smell the aromas. And of course, at that point, you wanted to try the recipe to see if you could do the same thing at home. Same thing happens with your book.
Well, I take that as the highest compliment.
It's meant that way.
Thank you.
You have a lot of professionals contributing here, aside from the survivors or their children themselves. Among them, you have my friend Gil Marks, who has been on this radio show, has also posted on my blog. You have Jeff Nathan from Abigail's, who has also been on this show and posted on my blog, and quite a few others. Truly a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you. Well, I feel like I'm in very good company then. It was a controversial move to have some of the professional chefs, because some people felt that it was taking away from the survivors' recipes. And I looked at it differently, as did all of the survivors that I spoke to. And the reason we included them, there were times where I did not know a particular recipe, and I was very busy writing the stories and testing the dishes I had, and it just seemed practical to reach out to someone who is so talented, such as a Jeff Nathan or Susie Fishbein or Arthur Schwartz, who stayed on the phone with me as I prepared pacha, and we had many good laughs together. I said to him as I was cooking the pacha, I said, "Arthur, something is going terribly wrong. It smells like an animal has died in my kitchen." And he laughed and he said, "Oh, June, it means it's ready." So, you know, I had moments like that with these very gracious and generous people who helped me with some of the recipes. And I think it helped round out the book and gave it another little dimension that we all enjoyed. I'm glad that you appreciate the writing style. I try very, very hard to write as if you are standing in the kitchen with me, and that you are one of my children, one of my friends, you know, my father, my sister, my husband, and I'm explaining to you why I'm doing what I'm doing and giving you a little bit of background and walking you through the recipe. And I'm glad that you appreciate it because it's very conversational. It's actually very light. There's nothing really very heavy in my writing style, and I'm glad that you appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, let's turn for a few moments to your other book, your new book, The Kosher Carnivore.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the writing is superb. As I was reading your introduction, I couldn't put it down. as a student of food writing, I find it to be one of the prime examples of food writing at its best.
Thank you.
Now,
thank you. That's lovely to hear.
And it's also meant.
Thank you.
As it sounds. As I leaf through the book again, I see a lot of classics. I see a lot of innovations on some of the classics. Among my favorites, and a very easy to make, is the steak pizzaiola.
Mm-hmm.
But I must take issue with you. On one of them, you're sacrilegious. Tapless chicken pot pie.
Yes.
I mean, I love the idea, but for God's sake, tapless? I cannot imagine it.
Well, you know,
is that
allowed
or is that against a religion?
Well, it is, and I'm glad you appreciate the humor. You know, just by the title, the fact that we just put it out there and called it the Kosher Carnivore, we made no bones about it. This was going to be a book with meat and poultry, and really one of the nice things is that all of the side dishes that are in the Kosher Carnivore are all part.
Yes.
So you could prepare every single dish in that book, put it all on one table, and you wouldn't break a single rule. So I was really, I look at most kosher cookbooks, and they're either holiday-driven, or they have certainly both, you know, dairy recipes and meat recipes. I was really dedicated to the concept that every recipe in the book would be able to be paired together, that there would be no limitations, that if you said, oh, my goodness, those mashed potatoes sound fabulous, I want them with the fried chicken, that there would not be a problem, because in those creamy mashed potatoes, there's no butter, there's no cream, no kidding. It's just a great recipe of how to make really creamy mashed potatoes that you can eat with meat and poultry. There are not a lot of cookbooks that do that. The other thing that we really wanted to do in the book was to teach people, because a lot of people are intimidated when they go to the butcher. You know, kosher consumers, unlike a regular supermarket consumer, can't just walk into any store and just walk up to the counter, buy a piece of meat, and walk out of the store. Very often they have to go to a private butcher. And I think it's very intimidating when you walk in and you see all the butchers in the white coats and they're all looking very professional and you get a little tongue-tied and you just say, I'll take that. And I really wanted to change that. I wanted to empower the consumer to walk into a store and know exactly what cut of meat they wanted, what dish it works best in, why they should ask for something from the shoulder rather than something from the plate, why it's better to have short ribs from one section than another, why a prime rib of beef is so very fabulous because of the marbling, why a brisket has the qualities that it does, what needs to be braised, what needs to be grilled. I wanted to really impart a lot of good, solid information, along with some truly yummy recipes. I post those recipes all the time on my blog at junehirsch.com, and it's a way for me to continually invent new recipes and to connect with the readers and say, well, if you like chicken fried steak, why don't you try this? Here's another spin on it. And, I found that book so much fun to write.
Well, talking about your blog, I like the humor in some of the titles. For example, Rugelach, Yiddish for lots of work for a small pastry.
Well, you know, I made a batch of Rugelach this weekend, and I'm going to say that between the preparation, the chilling of the dough, the temperamental dough that you have to deal with, and anyone who's ever made Rugelach knows, if your kitchen is 5 degrees too warm, that dough is going to turn to batter in a matter of minutes. It takes so much finesse. And it's painstaking. And then at the end of the day, you end up with 3 dozen little cookies that honestly disappear in 3 minutes. And you say, oh, my goodness, I spent 12 hours making those cookies.
But the fact that they disappear so fast, that's a tribute to whoever baked them.
I would like to think so. But, yes, I try to be – I think there's so much content on the Internet that is heavy or takes itself way too seriously. And I'm going to say, I just don't have the patience for that. If I don't find the fun in writing it, I'm probably not going to write it. There are some blogs that I actually start writing and I go, no, this just isn't coming off as lighthearted as I want. And I put it away and I look at it again at another day when maybe I have a more lighthearted attitude. I think food should be entertaining and joyful and celebratory, mm-hmm. and it should make us feel good, and it should make us feel loved, and it shouldn't necessarily take us all day, but if it does, okay, then I'd like to think the family and friends you're cooking for are worth that effort. So I try to write like that in both the books and on the blog. I try to tweet like that. I just try to make things a little bit more fun. I think we can use a little bit more fun in our lives.
Absolutely. And you have succeeded phenomenally in that, in both books.
Thank you.
Now, I'm going to ask you if you can give us any interesting anecdotes, whether funny, whether touching, gut-wrenching, or just plain interesting. But before that, I'm going to read from the introduction to your recipes, remembered a little conversation you had with one of the subjects you interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is about Regina Feiner.
Yes, she was my first interview.
Right. And you have in the conversation her daughter Evelyn Goldfire.
Yes.
So I'm going to start by reading me, meaning you. So, Regina, tell me about the food that you remember enjoying as a child, something you still make today. Regina, tuskies, potato dumplings. Me, do you have the recipe? Regina, I don't need a recipe to make them. Me, well, can you describe to me how you go about it so I can start your recipe with others? I can share your recipe with others? Regina, well, you pick some potatoes. Me, how many? Regina, how many? I never counted. Evelyn, Mom, when you make dumplings, do you buy a bag of potatoes? Regina, of course. I buy a bag. The price is much better when you buy a bag. Evelyn, and when you make your dumplings, do you use the entire bag? Regina, what? You think I would waste potatoes? Evelyn, and can you carry an entire bag of potatoes? Regina, who else is going to carry them for me? Evelyn to me, start with 5 pounds of potatoes.
And, you know, it was so many of the recipes unfolded that way where it was really a process of getting them out. There are so many stories in the book. You know, I write in the introduction that at its heart, it's a cookbook. In its soul, it's a storybook. And it's really, it's the stories that bring the recipes to life. The recipes are the pleasure that you get. It's almost like the dessert, and the story is the main course. And in listening to people such as Mary Mayer, she was one of the lovely women that I interviewed. I went to her home on a very snowy day, and she greeted me at the door with, Mamala, I'm so sorry you came out in this weather. I don't have a story to tell. And about 3 hours later, I left with a plate of mandelbread and delicious Linzer tart cookies. Her Linzer tart cookies are in the book, and they're one of my favorite recipes. And a beautiful story. And she told me how as a Jewish girl in Hungary, she grew up in a very privileged home. And when the war came to Hungary, which was, you know, toward the end, but it came so fast and furious. It was the final solution. And so many Hungarians perished very quickly, whereas those who were from Poland remained in the camps for a very long period of time. Those who were Hungary were rounded up very quickly and perished very quickly. And Mary was very lucky that she was able to get false papers and escape across from one side of Budapest, which, you know, is separated. It's Buda and Ispest, and it's separated by the
right.
Danube River. And she went to work on the other side. And when the war was over and the Russian tanks came through her town to liberate them, she asked them in Russian, because she was very educated, she said, please take me to the border, take me to the river. I want to cross the bridge and go home. And when they got to the bridge had been blown out by the Nazis. And the Russian soldiers in Russian said to her, what do you want us to do? You can't get home now. And I looked at her and I said, Mary, what is it you did? And without missing a beat, she said, oh, it was fine, sweetheart. I waited for winter. The Danube froze, and I walked across the frozen river. And when you listen to stories like that, and you realize our day-to-day lives and the things that we complain about and the inconveniences that we feel are such very big deals, and then you listen to a woman who did not think she had a story to tell me, but she walked across the frozen Danube to get home after the war. It's stories like that that make this book so incredibly singular, unique, special, vital. It's a book, understand, Chaim, every penny of this book goes to charity. Every penny earned, which is now in excess of $130,000, goes to the Museum of Jewish Heritage to help further educating about tolerance, about the Holocaust, about our glorious past, and about our magnificent future as the Jewish people. And we can support their work by buying this book. I don't get a new handbag because I sold thousands of this book. I don't own a new pair of shoes because I talk about this book. But the Museum of Jewish Heritage can now contribute to the greater good and teach about the Holocaust. That's why I feel it's so important for every one of your listeners, everyone who is touched by any of these stories or wants to learn more of the recipes, not just to go to my website and read more about me. It's not about me. It's about this remarkable community that is aging, that is vanishing, whose stories need to be remembered, and about going on Amazon or going to the Museum of Jewish Heritage and having a copy of this book in your home and in your children's home and in your friends' homes, making this part of your cherished library. That's why I wrote the book. The Kosher Carnivore, I give a good chunk of the money to Mazan, A Jewish Response to Hunger, and I hope they buy the book because it's fabulous food. But Recipes Remembered needs to be part of every Jewish person's home. It's an obligation. It's part of our responsibility as Jewish people to perpetuate these stories and to preserve these food memories.
You're absolutely right. It's also part of our vengeance against the Nazis to show them that in spite of their best efforts, we're here and we will long be here after they have become forgotten footnotes in some disappearing volume of forgotten historical lore.
Yes, Olivai, and that is such a lesson, and it's interesting that you said that as we come close to a close, because so many of my survivors said the best revenge they've had is leading a good life, a productive life,
right,
a life of tikkun
right,
olam, of healing the world, a life of bringing Jewish children into this world, educating them to be strong Jewish citizens of the world. That's their best revenge. That's the way they showed the Nazis that they didn't win. They took an awful lot of us with them, but they didn't win because we're still here and we're still strong and we're still thriving.
Okay, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure having you as a guest. You are phenomenal. There is so much I still wanted to cover, but unfortunately we're out of time. We'll have to do it some other time.
I would love
that. Hopefully you'll agree to come back to the program.
Very good, and I hope I hear from some of your listeners. I hope they either contact me through the website, post comments maybe to the blog. Let me know that they heard. Tell me what they want to hear more of. Tell me what recipes they want to hear. go on and read more content and get back to me. I love feedback, and so it would be great to hear from
Give
some
us
of them.
The address of your blog again,
it's,
of your blog and of your website.
It's www.junehersh, and that's JuneHersh.com. And they can find me on Facebook under that name. They can follow me at Twitter under that name. And they can certainly go on my website where my blog is and let me know they listen to this wonderful radio broadcast and the wonderful blogs that you contribute and the content that you contribute on the topic of Jewishness and the kosher world. And thank you for doing that.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you very, very much. Good night, and thank you to all our listeners. Good night,
thank
one and
you.
All. And come back to listen to us again next Wednesday when our guest will be Shifra Kline from Bet Avon magazine. Thank you, and good night.